You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Over last summer, as wildfires, floods, and hurricanes and other weather-related events seemed to follow each other over and over, we conducted a series of interviews with people around the energy and environmental interface. And now, with the Vermont Climate Council racing to produce a report by its December 1st deadline on how the state will meet its carbon emission targets, while another state committee works on an energy plan, what we heard from the several people we talked to who are deeply involved in this area we felt was important to share. An earlier piece we released on the subject was a conversation with Meredith Angwin, who is one of the country's foremost experts on the nation's electric grid. Another was with Thomas Hand, a solar developer. Today we're going to hear from someone we've had the pleasure of discussing these issues with before, Ed Cameron, an area resident and consultant who works with government, business, international organizations, nonprofits, academic institutions, and philanthropies. We've edited this conversation lightly for length and clarity, but rather than merge it with a couple of other voices, decided to air it close to its original length.
The thing that has been kind of on my mind a lot when I think about the subject is, how do we get to, you know, economically viable renewables and driving energy? I mean, is there a pathway that you're able to see that is going to, like, sort of make that economic argument, you know, just redundant to the point where in the not too distant future, solar and wind and other alternatives, renewables really can basically heat homes, power cars, you know, all the rest of it that we need to have happen?
So there's a very long answer to this question because it's an issue that you have to sort of segment and sequence. So the first thing to say is the technology that we need in order to not only deploy more renewable energy, but also improve energy efficiency, so that we get more value and less harm from the energy we do use, that technology is available to us today. And it's not available in only one form. It's available in multiple forms that can be applied to specific local contexts. So in some cases, wind energy is going to be the best option. In other cases, solar. In other cases, geothermal. In other cases, tidal power. But we have a whole range of different types of energy solutions that are available to us today and are ready to drive this transition right now. They all need more innovation, particularly around energy storage and energy transmission, but we already have enough today to embark. When it comes to the economics, there's a couple of things we need to do. First thing we need to do is we need to better understand the fact that there is a cost to inaction. And a lot of the times, all you're told about is the cost of action, but there's a cost to inaction. So for example, the United States suffers annually $300 billion in losses as a consequence of climate-induced events. That can be the effects of the Atlantic hurricane season. It can be the effects of flooding in the Midwest. It can be the effects of heat waves and wildfires in California. That has real consequences for individuals and households. Already, as a consequence of congressional appropriation to pay for that damage, the average American taxpayer is paying $1,000 per person every year to cover the cost of climate damage. It also has massive implications for companies. PG&E, the largest utility in the nation, went into bankruptcy as a consequence of being complicit in the California wildfires between 2017 and 2019. And we know that globally, up to $43 trillion, which is more than half the global economy, is at risk from climate impacts between now and the end of the century. So the first thing we have to do is understand that there is enormous cost to individuals, to households, to communities, to companies, to the country of failing to act. Second thing we need to understand is that fossil fuels have been kept artificially low in price for decades because of perverse subsidies. More than $600 billion globally on an annual basis is spent keeping fossil fuels artificially low. Sometimes that's in the form of corporate welfare to utility companies. In other countries, it's in the form of price controls to keep the price low for end consumers. But massive amounts of public money is spent keeping this particular resource extremely cheap. That's extremely detrimental to our economy, by the way, because most of the money spent on fossil fuel is spent on labor, sorry, spent on resource and extraction and rights to resource, whereas most of the money spent on renewable energy is actually on labor, because it generates far more jobs when you create renewable energy than when you create energy using fossil fuels. Then you have to think about, in addition to the economic cost and the incentives, you have to think about the benefit to the economy of spending that little bit extra on renewable energy. So in the context of a state like Vermont, somewhere in the region of 96 to 98 cents out of every dollar spent on fossil fuel leaves the state and goes into the pockets of people living elsewhere. That isn't the case when it comes to renewable energy generation in Vermont. When it's renewable energy that you're buying in Vermont, most of the money stays here, which means most of the money is recirculated in this economy and spent in our small businesses, which we value so highly. And in addition to that, right now in the United States, renewable energy is creating jobs 12 times faster than the rest of the economy. So it is a jobs program. It is a stimulus program, as well as an emissions reductions program when you invest in renewables rather than in fossil fuels. And then, of course, as you alluded to in your question, you have the fact that now the price point of renewables is competitive, whereas it wasn't 5, 10, 15 years ago. So if you eliminate these perverse subsidies, the economic argument in and of itself, because of price point, is a win. The job creation opportunity is a win. The local economic development opportunity is a win. The avoided costs of environmental and climate harm is a win. The emissions reductions that we have that contribute to global climate stabilization is a win. Renewable energy over fossil fuels is a win every time.
So what needs to happen here in Vermont to kind of, you know, number one, get us to the state goals that we have? I think they start in 2025. Is that gap still so wide that to try and get to those goals that were set just going to be really a tough battle, or are we kind of getting close and it's just a matter of persistence?
Well, I actually think that in the case of Vermont, the problem is not the goals and can we get there. The problem is, have we set the right goals? And what I mean by that is over 90% of the electricity generated in Vermont already comes from renewable sources. It comes mostly from hydropower, of course. So the real issue in Vermont when it comes to climate action is not electricity. I have spent time in Montpelier, and I can recall going on one occasion and speaking with a number of lawmakers from both the House and the Senate. And I posed three questions to them. I said, are you trying to reduce emissions in Vermont? Or are you trying to build a low carbon, resilient and inclusive economy in Vermont? Or are you trying to contribute to global decarbonization? And they sort of looked at me as if I was an alien creature. And they said, well, isn't that just the same way of asking the same question in three different ways? And I said, actually, no, they're fundamentally different questions that have fundamentally different goals with fundamentally different policies. So if you take the first one, emissions reductions in Vermont, Vermont is responsible for 0.1% of 26% of global emissions. And Vermont's problem is mostly transport and agriculture and energy used for heating. It's not really about electricity. And yet, by far, the most energy and attention, politically speaking, in Vermont, when it comes to reducing emissions, has been on energy, and particularly electricity, and very little attention has been paid to what we do about the agricultural sector. And in particular, how do we make sure that we dramatically reduce emissions in agriculture while at the same time providing a just transition for farmers and farming communities? If your question, second question, how do you create a low carbon, resilient and inclusive economy in Vermont? That's very different. That's about understanding that a low carbon economy is already being created all around the world. And there are more than 6,000 companies out there who've already committed to science-based emissions reductions targets, very aggressive emissions reductions. And they're now looking for a state to house their operations, to house their workforce, to welcome in their inward investment. Why isn't Vermont actively going out and seeking those companies the way we used to go and seek tech workers in Manhattan with a $10,000 inducement to relocate to Vermont? Why don't we have a state climate ambassador whose job it is to turn the fact that this is a green state with a progressive climate policy into a source of inward investment? We don't have that. And then finally, the third question, if you want to contribute to global decarbonization, it's really not about what we do in electricity in Vermont. It's about what is the state attorney general of Vermont doing right now in terms of partnering with other states around the nation to hold the federal government accountable for its failure to reduce greenhouse gases in the United States more broadly. Perhaps the most significant climate leader in Vermont over the past 20 years was the state attorney general who joined the famous Massachusetts versus EPA court case of 2007, which led to greenhouse gas emissions reductions at the federal level under the Clean Air Act. So here's what I'm getting at with this long answer. We don't just need goals in Vermont. We need creativity. We need imagination. We need an understanding of how we as a state not only contribute to solving this problem globally, but how we benefit from solving that problem. And the reason for that is, as I go around this state and our neighboring states, I see towns who have suffered from an opioid crisis. I've seen towns that have suffered from deindustrialization. I've seen towns that have suffered from globalization. I see towns that are suffering from underemployment as well as unemployment. And I see towns that are suffering from COVID. The last thing these towns need is another crisis. What they need is opportunity. And there is an opportunity out there in the creation of a low carbon economy. Why are we not seizing that opportunity? That is a source of frustration for me. And I think the Climate Council that's being created deserves an awful lot of credit for having been created, deserves an awful lot of credit for the fact that it is looking at how we go about emissions reductions in Vermont, but also needs to have its feet held to the fire for its lack of imagination and creativity, and for only looking at this as crisis and not looking at this sufficiently as opportunity.
Sure. Let me just ask about one aspect of that, the transportation sector. I mean, in the last couple of years, we've heard an awful lot about electric vehicles, and that's the answer, or at least one of the answers to the transportation deficit we have here in Vermont with fossil fuels and vehicles and stuff. Do you have the sense that the infrastructure of charging stations for electric vehicles is advancing as rapidly as it should be? I mean, I think until you get that, I know range anxiety, I guess is the term, yep, I kind of dealt with, it's hard to see how electric vehicles are really going to take off. And they're certainly not going to take off if there's only a handful of charging stations around and sometimes not always convenient places.
Well, I think the fact is they are taking off and they will take off, and this will happen for a number of reasons. So if you look at sales, again, globally, over the course of the last number of years, it is staggering, not only how many electric vehicles are sold, but also how the technology has advanced, also how the price point has advanced, and also how the spread of electric vehicles has moved from being compact cars to sedans to now covering the full range of vehicles that we use, even up to the heavy duty 18 wheelers that are used to ship goods and services around the world. So the speed of technology has been really quite remarkable. Combined with that, you now have countries right around the world who have actually committed to ending the internal combustion engine by certain dates. The furthest date out that I've seen is 2035. So we are actually living, I think, in the last decade of the internal combustion engine as mass transportation. There will always be people, of course, who own an old vintage car as a hobby, for example. But in terms of mass transportation, this is the last decade of the internal combustion engine. And that's a reality because the automotive companies have made that decision for themselves and because public policy has put in place the incentives for that. So again, we are going to be dealing with more electric vehicles. Can we keep pace, therefore, by, for example, putting in place the right charging infrastructure, by making sure, for example, that battery storage not just provides more range, but is compatible with cold climates, which hasn't always been the case, and by making sure, for example, that electric vehicles are provided in a way that is compatible for a state like Vermont. One of the reasons I don't have an electric vehicle is because when I bought my car, there wasn't a four-wheel drive version of an electric vehicle available. So I think what we need to understand is over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, all of the reasons, legitimate reasons, why you or someone else might be hesitant about this purchase, those reasons are going to disappear. And we're going to have far better options available to us in terms of choice, in terms of price point. That does mean that the state government needs to invest in this infrastructure. And I believe that is the plan, particularly with regards to how they will use the infrastructure money coming from Washington. That is the plan. We shouldn't only, however, rely on private electric vehicles. There should be, again, commitments to public transportation where that makes sense. And there should be more of a commitment to ride sharing. I mean, we need to think about not just why we own a car, but what we use a car for. And are there other things we can do in lieu of using a car for every mobility need that we have? And again, learning lessons from other parts of the world will provide us with some of the answers to those questions that we need. But I don't think it's any more a question of, are electric vehicles coming? They are coming. They've already arrived. How do we now make sure, again, that as a state, we have all the infrastructure we need in order to make them as user-friendly as possible? And that's really a public investment question.
Maybe the big breakthrough is right around the corner or whatever.
Well, let's just talk about that for a second, though, because before you get to the big breakthrough, you can still do things to address the issue of emissions from your car. So I think too much of our attention has been on the engine. But the size of your car matters, and the aerodynamics of your car matters, and how frequently you use your car matters. So there's individual choices that we can make in lieu of waiting for the infrastructure that can still help to drive down emissions. So, for example, I live about 10 minutes drive from the center of Manchester, and I no longer drive into the center of Manchester. I bike. So we need to make choices as individuals as well about reducing the unnecessary usage of our vehicles, whether it's an electric vehicle or an internal combustion engine. Let's use these vehicles for when they're appropriate, and let's use the other means that are available to us when those means are actually fit for purpose.
Mm, yeah, good point. But I guess I'm just finding myself wondering, you know, if some of the forecasts for what happens if global temperatures rise 1.5 to 2 centigrade over the next 10 years or so, how does that affect Vermont? Is that a ski season concern? Is that a maple syrup business concern? I mean, it's of course everyone's concern in a variety of ways, but I'm just wondering if we don't kind of make some headway on some of those questions, what are some of the likely outcomes for the state's economy here if we just sort of sit around and don't really get anything done?
So the typical way of understanding climate risk is to divide it into two categories. And one category is called physical risk, and one category is called transition risk. So if we deal first with physical risk, the ways in which that affects Vermont are things like the changes in the distribution of water. We're likely to see more flooding, for example, than we've seen previously. It is changing in both the length and the strength of our winters, which means we are likely to see ski season affected. It is, for example, the change to our biodiversity. One of the things that we're seeing, for example, is we no longer have the cold kill-off of the various types of smaller mammals that affect our homes every single year because of the way in which winters are changing in Vermont. I think perhaps the biggest story, and the one that is perhaps most underserved, is the change in vector and waterborne diseases, particularly vector-borne diseases, particularly Lyme disease. It's quite frightening to me how many calls the medical centers in Vermont are now getting on an annual basis as a consequence of people who are finding ticks, who are being bitten by ticks, and are finding that those ticks are infected with Lyme. So I think there's a variety of ways in which obviously maple syrup and fall foliage is something else. So there's a variety of ways in which physical risk will manifest in Vermont. But the other thing we have to bear in mind is this transition risk. As we're building a low carbon economy right around the world, that will also have implications for Vermont and whether or not we thrive or we're left behind. So most of the things that we buy in Vermont, those things are coming from other states or even other parts of the world. And as companies and countries go about the process of reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, there will be much more pressure on us to be able to produce what we use locally. Are we set up to do that or not? There will also be much more pressure, of course, for us to contribute by reducing our own emissions. Are we set up to do that or not? There are opportunities out there. Quebec to our north is one of the best provinces or states in North America at seizing the opportunities of transition. Are we set up to follow Quebec's example, or are we going to be left behind? So it's not just about how we deal with the physical risks of climate change as they exist today. It's, are we ready for the fact that a new economy is being created? That economy is low carbon energy, low carbon food systems, low carbon transport. Are we ready for that new future? Or are we too far behind to seize the opportunities of it? And again, one of my criticisms of how Vermont is treating this issue is it's not looking at the transition, it's only looking at the physical. We don't have the luxury when it comes to climate change to looking at things in one dimension. We have to have the foresight, we have to have the experience and expertise to look at things in three dimensions. And again, that comes back to the issue of, do we have creativity and imagination in the state to look at the risks, to look at the opportunities, to manage the risks well, to embrace the opportunities?
Mm-hmm. Do you think at this point the federal government is being a useful partner in some of this, or is it still a case where, communication or whatever, or cooperation is sadly lacking compared to what the need is?
So obviously, I would say, because it's factually correct, that the federal government that we have as of August 2021 is far more advanced on this issue than the federal government we had as of this time last year. And if you were to look at the president's climate agenda, it is the most ambitious climate agenda that the United States has ever had, both in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions reductions, but also its commitment to things like resilience and its commitment to things like justice. Its understanding, for example, of the interface between environmental degradation and inequality, and particularly race. So I would say it's a very comprehensive plan. I would say that it is deep in terms of its goals. It has very, very strong emissions reductions goals. I would say that for the first time, we have something that approaches a full government approach to this problem. It's not just the State Department negotiating a diplomatic agreement. It's not just the Department of Energy. It's also the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Interior. And crucially, it's the Treasury and the Treasury Secretary thinking about how you spend money and invest in infrastructure that's low carbon. But a couple of things I would say. The first is, history tells us that a two-term president in the United States is usually followed into office by someone from the opposite party. And where we're very, very far behind in the United States, and also in Vermont, is we have not built a societal consensus on this issue. So we cannot afford to spend the next 4 or 8 years celebrating President Biden if we're not spending a large amount of time trying to persuade our Republican and conservative friends and neighbors that this is their issue, that this affects them, that the risks are risks for them, that the opportunities are opportunities for them. This can no longer be a Democratic issue. It's got to be an American issue. And that means we've got to spend real time building societal consensus. That's lacking in the United States. That's not only worrisome for the US, but it undermines everything we try to achieve around the world. If you do not have US leadership on this issue, you cannot solve the problem. If you do not have societal consensus in the United States, you cannot solve the problem. What? The second thing is that the US commitment, although far better than it was, is still not a match for what's being done in other countries. So as ambitious as the US federal government approach is, it's way behind what the Europeans are doing. So I think one of the things we need to do is we need to have a degree of modesty and say that we need to look to other parts of the world. We need to learn from what other parts of the world are doing, because they're much further ahead on this issue than we are. We need to have a degree of humility, and we need to bring some of those lessons back into the United States. Stimulus spending is one example. Other parts of the world were much better at using their stimulus money to build back better and low carbon than, for example, the stimulus money in the United States has been.
What do you think that is, that there's so much resistance to this amongst certain segments of the population? Is it a cultural thing where, it's just perceived as being some left-wing dark agenda, or is it just natural kind of attachment to traditional ways of doing things that hold certain people back?
So I've given a lot of thought about this, because I've been working on policy engagement in the United States for very, very, very many years. And when you have so much failure in your life, you step back and think, well, what can I do differently? And so I think part of the problem is that it's not one thing. It's many, many things. It starts, I think, with some founding American philosophies. Manifest destiny, for example, is the notion that we have control over our environment. Well, we don't. We're part of an environment. The environment influences us and we influence it, but we must live in concert with it. So I think this notion of the American man in particular having dominion over nature is a real fundamental problem that we suffer from. The second one is American exceptionalism, the notion that we can stand apart from the rest of the world as the rest of the world goes about trying to solve this problem is a real issue. More recently, I think part of the issue has been that, for example, people in my community, the environment community, we've been very, very bad at communicating this issue. We've communicated as something that is very scientific. We've communicated as polar bears and ice caps. We've really failed to communicate it as jobs and homes and family and faith and human rights. We've really done a bad job, I think, of selling the issue. And that means it's been very easy for people to switch off. We have talked about it in the language of fear. We haven't talked about it in the language of opportunity. Then I think you have the vested interests. You have the large multinational companies, many of whom are high carbon industry companies, gas and oil and coal, who spent an absolute fortune trying to sow seeds of doubt into the American population. And unfortunately, many of those same companies have been funding the political campaigns, particularly of people on the center right and right of our politics. And so now you have this vicious circle of companies and politicians and elements of the media who are constantly propagating this myth. The first myth is that climate change isn't happening. Well, it is. The second myth is that it is happening, but we're not causing it. Well, we are causing it. And the third myth is it's too costly to do anything about it. Well, the real truth is it's too costly to do nothing about it. So there's too many myths that are being propagated by our political leaders, by some in our corporate leadership, and by the media, that I think really prevents people from getting a good understanding of why this is important, why it benefits me to address it, and how I can actually address it. And this, frankly, doesn't exist in other parts of the world. The Paris Agreement was signed by 196 countries. Only one country withdrew. And of those 195 remaining countries, you've got every political persuasion known to humankind. You've got the communist Chinese and the socialist revolutionaries of Bolivia. You've got the theocrats of Iran and the conservatives of the United Kingdom. You've got the Christian Democrats of Germany and the socialists of France. You've got every single thing from the far left to the far right. They've all signed up to this because they know we have to solve this problem. But unfortunately, the United States is the outlier.
We'll be hearing more from others in the climate, energy, efficiency, and environmental areas as we go on, and from all perspectives, as we tackle this urgent question. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.